4.
Kesnokati's old woman says it's going to snow. His friend's voice murmured near him. We should be ready if there comes a chance for us to run away.
Falk did not reply, but sat listening with sharpening hearing to the noises of the camp. Voices in a foreign tongue, distance softened. The dry sound of somebody nearby scraping a hide, the thin ball of a baby, the snapping of the tent fire. Horesens! Someone outside summoned him, and he got up promptly, then stood still. In a moment his friend's hand was on his arm, and she guided him to where they wanted him, the communal fire in the center of the circle of tents, where they were celebrating a successful hunt by roasting a whole bull. A shank of beef was shoved into his hands. He sat down on the ground and began to eat. Juices and melted fat ran down his jaws, but he did not wipe them off. To do so was beneath the dignity of a hunter of the Mizura Society of the Basnaska Nation. Though a stranger, a captive, and blind, he was a hunter, and was learning to comport himself as such. The more defensive a society, the more conformist. The people he was among walked a very narrow, a tortuous and cramped way across the broad, free plains. So long as he was among them, he must follow all the twistings of their ways exactly. The diet of the Basnaska consisted of fresh, half-raw beef, raw onions, and blood. Wild herdsmen of the wild cattle, like wolves, they culled the lame, the lazy, and unfit from the vast herds, a lifelong feast of meat, a life with no rest. They hunted with hand lasers and warded strangers from their territory with bomb birds like the one that had destroyed Falk's slider, tiny impact missiles programmed to home in on anything that contained a fusion element. They did not make or repair these weapons themselves, and handled them only after purifications and incantations. Where they obtained them, Falk had not found out, though there was occasional mention of a yearly pilgrimage which might be connected with the weapons. They had no agriculture, and no domestic animals. They were illiterate, and did not know, except perhaps through certain myths and hero legends, any of the history of humankind. They informed Falk that he had not come out of the forest, because the forest was inhabited only by giant white snakes. They practiced a monotheistic religion whose rituals involved mutilation, castration, and human sacrifice. It was one of the outgrowth superstitions of their complex creed that had induced them to take Falk alive and make him a member of the tribe. Normally, since he carried a laser and thus was above slave status, they would have cut out his stomach and liver to examine for auguries, and then let the women hack him up as they pleased. However, a week or two before his capture, an old man of the Mizura Society had died, there being no as yet unnamed infant in the tribe to receive his name. It was given to the captive, who, blinded, disfigured, and only conscious at intervals, still was better than nobody. For so long as old Horesens kept his name, his ghost, evil like all ghosts, would return to trouble the ease of the living. So the name was taken from the ghost and given to Falk, along with the full initiations of a hunter, a ceremony which included whippings, emetics, dances, the recital of dreams, tattooing, antiphonal free association, feasting, sexual abuse of one woman by all the males in turn, and finally night-long incantations to the god to preserve the new Horesens from harm. After this, they left him on a horsehide rug in a cowhide tent, delirious and unattended, to die or recover, while the ghost of old Horesens, nameless and powerless, went whining away on the wind across the plains. The woman, who, when he had first recovered consciousness, had been busy bandaging his eyes and looking after his wounds, also came whenever she could to care for him.
He had only seen her when, for brief moments in the semi-privacy of his tent, he could lift the bandage which her quick wits had provided him when he was first brought in. Had the Basnaska seen those eyes of his open, they would have cut out his tongue so he could not name his own name, and then burned him alive. She had told him this and other matters he needed to know about the nation of the Basnaska, but not much about herself. Apparently she had not been with the tribe very much longer than himself. He gathered that she had been lost on the prairie, and had joined the tribe rather than starve to death. They were willing to accept another she-slave for the use of the men, and she had proved skillful at doctoring, so they let her live. She had reddish hair. Her voice was very soft. Her name was Estrel. Beyond this, he knew nothing about her, and she had not asked him anything at all about himself, not even his name. He had escaped lightly, all things considered. Parastolis, the noble matter of ancient Cetian science, would not explode nor take fire, so the slider had not blown up under him, though its controls were wrecked. The bursting missile had chewed the left side of his head and upper body with fine shrapnel, but Estrel was there with the skill and a few of the materials of medicine. There was no infection. He recuperated fast, and within a few days of his blood christening as Horesens, he was planning escape with her. But the days went on, and no chances came. A defensive society, a wary, jealous people, all their actions rigidly scheduled by rite, custom, and taboo. Though each hunter had his tent, women were held in common, and all a man's doings were done with other men. They were less a community than a club or herd, interdependent members of one entity. In this effort to attain security, independence and privacy, of course, were suspect. Falk and Estrel had to snatch at any chance to talk for a moment. She did not know the forest dialect, but they could use Galactica, which the Basnaska spoke only in a pidgin form. "The time to try," she said once, "might be during a snowstorm, when the snow would hide us and our tracks. But how far could we get on foot in a blizzard? You've got a compass, but the cold..." Falk's winter cloth clothing had been confiscated, along with everything else he possessed, even the gold ring he had always worn. They had left him one gun. That was integral with his being a hunter and could not be taken from him. But the clothes he had worn so long now covered the bony ribs and shanks of the old hunter Kesnokati, and he had his compass only because Estrel had got it and hidden it before they went through his pack. He and she were well enough clothed in Basnaska buckskin shirts and leggings with boots and parkas of red cowhide, but nothing was adequate shelter from one of the prairie blizzards with their hard sub-freezing winds, except walls, roof, and a fire. "If we can get across into Samsit territory, just a few miles west of here, we could hole up in an old place I know there and hide till they give up looking. I thought of trying it before you came, but I had no compass and was afraid of getting lost in the storm. With a compass and a gun, we might make it. We might not." "If it's our best chance," Falk said, "we'll take it." He was not quite so naive, so hopeful and easily swayed as he had been before his capture. He was a little more resistant and resolute. Though he had suffered at their hands, he had no special grudge against the Basnaska. They had branded him once and for all down both his arms with the blue tattoo slashes of their kinship, branding him as a barbarian, but also as a man. That was all right. But they had their business and he had his. The hard individual will developed in him by his training in the forest house demanded that he get free, that he get on with his journey, with what Zov had called man's work. These people were not going anywhere, nor did they come from anywhere, for they had cut their roots in the human past. It was not only the extreme precariousness of his existence among the Basnaska that made him impatient to get out. It was also a sense of suffocation, of being cramped and immobilized, which was harder to endure than the bandage that blanked his vision. That evening, Estrel stopped by his tent to tell him that it had begun to snow, and they were settling their plan in whispers when a voice spoke at the flap of the tent. Estrel translated quietly. He says, "Blind Hunter, do you want the Red Woman tonight?" She added no explanation. Falk knew the rules and etiquette of sharing the women around. His mind was busy with the matter of their talk, and he replied with the most useful of his short list of Basnaska words, "Meeg." "No." The male voice said something more imperative.
"If it goes on snowing, tomorrow night, maybe,"
Estrel murmured in Galactica. Still thinking, Falk did not answer. Then he realized she had risen and gone, leaving him alone in the tent. And after that he realized that she was the Red Woman, and that the other man had wanted her to copulate with. He could simply have said yes instead of no. And when he thought of her cleverness and gentleness towards him, the softness of her touch and voice, and the utter silence in which she hid her pride or shame, then he winced at his failure to spare her, and felt himself humiliated as her fellow man, and as a man. "We'll go tonight," he said to her next day in the drifted snow beside the women's lodge. "Come to my tent. Let a good part of the night pass first. Kokteki has told me to come to his tent tonight.
Can you slip away?"
"Maybe." "Which tent is Kokteki's?"
"Behind the Mizura Society lodge to the left. It has a patched place over the flap."
"If you don't come, I'll come get you."
"Another night there might be less danger."
"And less snow. Winter's getting on. This may be the last big storm. We'll go tonight."
"I'll come to your tent," she said with her unarguing, steady submissiveness.
He had left a slit in his bandage through which he could dimly see his way about, and he tried to see her now, but in the dull light she was only a gray shape in grayness. In the late dark of that night she came, quiet as the wind-blown snow against the tent. They each had ready what they had to take. Neither spoke. Falk fastened his oxhide coat, pulled up and tied the hood, and bent to unseal the door flap. He started aside as a man came pushing in from outside, bent double to clear the low gap. Kokteki, a burly, shaven-headed hunter, jealous of his status and his virility.
"Horesens, the Red Woman," he began,
then saw her in the shadows across the embers of the fire. At the same moment he saw how she and Falk were dressed, and their intent. He backed up to close off the doorway, or to escape from Falk's attack, and opened his mouth to shout. Without thought, reflex quick and certain, Falk fired his laser at point-blank range, and the brief flick of mortal light stopped the shout in the Basnaska's mouth, burnt away mouth and brain and life, in one moment, in perfect silence. Falk reached across the embers, caught the woman's hand, and led her over the body of the man he had killed into the dark. Fine snow and a light wind sifted and whirled, taking their breaths with cold. Estrel breathed in sobs. His left hand holding her wrist and his right his gun, Falk set off west among the scattered tents, which were barely visible as slits and webs of dim orange. Within a couple of minutes even these were gone, and there was nothing at all in the world but night and snow. Hand lasers of Eastern Forest make had several settings and functions. The handle served as a lighter, and the weapon tube converted to a not very efficient flashlight. Falk set his gun to give a glow by which he could read the compass and see the next few steps ahead, and they went on, guided by the mortal light. On the long rise where the Basnaska winter camp stood, the wind had thinned the snow cover. But as they went on, Unable to pick their course ahead, the compass west their one guideline in the confusion of the snowstorm that mixed air and ground into one whirling mess, they got onto lower land. There were 4- and 5-foot drifts through which Estrell struggled, gasping like a spent swimmer in high seas. Falk pulled out the rawhide drawstrings of his hood and tied it around his arm, giving her the end to hold, and then went ahead, making her a path. Once she fell, and the tug on the line nearly pulled him down. He turned and had to seek for a moment with the light before he saw her crouching in his tracks, almost at his feet. He knelt, and in the wan, snow-streaked sphere of light saw her face for the first time clearly. She was whispering, "This is more than I bargained for. Get your breath a while. We're out of the wind in this hollow." They crouched there together in a tiny bubble of light, around which hundreds of miles of wind-driven snow hurtled in darkness over the plains. She whispered something which at first he did not understand.
"Why did you kill the man?"
Relaxed, his senses dulled, drawing up resources of strength for the next stage of their slow, hard escape, Falk made no response. Finally, with a kind of grin, he muttered, "What else?"
"I don't know. You had to."
Her face was white and drawn with strain. He paid no attention to what she said. She was too cold to rest there, and he got to his feet, pulling her up with him. "Come on, it can't be much farther to the river." But it was much farther. She had come to his tent after some hours of darkness, as he thought of it. There was a word for hours in the forest tongue, though its meaning was imprecise and qualitative, since a people without business and communication across time and space have no use for timepieces. And the winter night had still a long time to run. They went on, and the night went on. As the first gray began to leaven the whirling black of the storm, they struggled down a slope of frozen, tangled grass and shrubs. A mighty, groaning bulk rose up straight in front of Falk and plunged off into the snow. Somewhere nearby, they heard the snorting of another cow or bull. And then, for a minute, the great creatures were all about them, white muzzles and wild, liquid eyes catching the light, the driven snow hillocky and bulking with flanks and shaggy shoulders. Then they were through the herd and came down to the bank of the little river that separated Basnaska from Samsit territory. It was fast, shallow, unfrozen. They had to wade, the current tugging at their feet over loose stones, pulling at their knees, icily rising till they struggled waist-deep through burning cold. Estrell's legs gave way under her before they were clear across. Falk hauled her up out of the water and through the ice-crusted reed-beds of the west bank, and then again crouched down by her in blank exhaustion among the snow-mounded bushes of the overhanging shore. He switched off his light gun, very faint but very large. A stormy day was gaining on the dark. "We have to go on. We've got to have a fire." She did not reply. He held her in his arms against him. Their boots and leggings and parkas from the shoulders down were frozen stiff already. The woman's face, bowed against his arm, was deathly white. He spoke her name, trying to rouse her. "Estrell, Estrell, come on. We can't stay here. We can get on a little farther. It won't be so hard. Come on, wake up, little one, little hawk, wake up." In his great weariness, he spoke to her as he had used to speak to Parth at daybreak a long time ago. She obeyed him at last, struggling to her feet with his help, getting the line into her frozen gloves, and step by step following him across the shore, up the low bluffs, and on through the tireless, relentless, driving snow. They kept along the river course, going south, as she had told him they would do when they had planned their run. He had no real hope they could find anything in this spinning whiteness, as featureless as the night storm had been. But before long they came to a creek tributary to the river they had crossed, and turned up it. Rough going, for the land was broken. They struggled on. It seemed to Falk that by far the best thing to do would be to lie down and fall asleep, and he was only unable to do this because there was someone who was counting on him, someone a long way off, a long time ago, who had sent him on a journey. He could not lie down, for he was accountable to someone. There was a croaking whisper in his ear, Estrell's voice. Ahead of them, a clump of high cottonwood boles loomed like starving wraiths in the snow, and Estrell was tugging at his arm. They began to stumble up and down the north side of the snow-choked creek just beyond the cottonwoods, searching for something. A stone, she kept saying, a stone. And though he did not know why they needed a stone, he searched and scrabbled in the snow with her. They were both crawling on hands and knees when at last she came on the landmark she was after, a snow-mounded block of stone a couple of feet high. With her frozen gloves she pushed away the dry drifts from the east side of the block. Incurious, listless with fatigue, Falk helped her. Their scraping bared a metal rectangle, level with the curiously level ground. Estrell tried to open it. A hidden handle clicked, but the edges of the rectangle were frozen shut. Falk spent his last strength straining to lift the thing, till finally he came to his wits and unsealed the frozen metal with the heat beam in the handle of his gun. Then they lifted up the door and looked down a neat, steep set of stairs, weirdly geometric amidst this howling wilderness, to a shut door. It's all right, his companion muttered, and going down the stairs, crawling backwards as on a ladder because she could not trust her legs, she pushed the door open and then looked up at Falk. Come on, she said. He came down, pulling the trapdoor to above him as she directed. It was abruptly, utterly dark, and crouching on the steps, Falk hastily pressed the stud of his handgun for light. Below him, Estrell's white face glimmered. He came down and followed her in the door, into a place that was very dark and very big, so big his light could only hint at the ceiling and the nearer walls. It was silent, and the air was dead, flowing past them in a faint, unchanging draft.
There should be wood over here,
Estrell's soft, strain-hoarsened voice said somewhere to his left.
Here. We need a fire. Help me with this.
Dry wood was stacked in high piles in a corner near the entrance. While he got a blaze going, building it up inside a circle of blackened stones near the center of the cavern, Estrell crept off into some farther corner and returned dragging a couple of heavy blankets. They stripped and rubbed down, then huddled in the blankets inside their Basnaska sleep rolls, up close to the fire. It burned hot, as if in a chimney, drawn up by a high draft that also carried off the smoke. There was no warming the great room or cave, but the firelight and heat relaxed and cheered them. Estrell got dried meat out of her bag, and they munched as they sat, though their lips were sore with frostbite, and they were too tired to be hungry. Gradually, the warmth of the fire began to soak into their bones. Who else has used this place?
Anyone that knows of it, I suppose.
There was a mighty house here once, if this was the cellar, Falk said, looking into the shadows that flickered and thickened into impenetrable black at a distance from the fire, and thinking of the great basements under the House of Fear.
They say there was a whole city here.
It goes on a long way from the door, they say.
I don't know.
How did you know of it? Are you a Samsit woman?
No.
He asked no further, recalling the code. But presently she said in her submissive way,
I am a wanderer. We know many places like this, hiding places.
I suppose you've heard of the Wanderers.
A little, said Falk, stretching out and looking across the fire at his companion. Tawny hair curled about her face as she sat huddled in the shapeless bag, and the pale jade amulet at her throat caught the firelight.
They know little of us in the forest.
No wanderers came as far east as my house. What was told of them there fits the Basnaska better. Savages, hunters, nomads. He spoke sleepily, laying his head down on his arm.
Some wanderers might be called savages, others not. The cattle hunters are all savages, and know nothing beyond their own territories. These Basnaska and Samsit and Arksa. We go far. We go east to the forest and south to the mouth of the inland river, and west over the great mountains, and the western mountains even to the sea. I myself have seen the sun set in the sea, behind the chain of blue isles that lies far off the coast, beyond the drowned valleys of California, earthquake-whelmed.
Her soft voice had slipped into the cadence of some archaic chant or plaint.
Go on, Falk murmured.
But she was still, and before long he was fast asleep. For a while she watched his sleeping face. At last she pushed the embers together, whispered a few words as if in prayer to the amulet chained around her neck, and curled down to sleep across the fire from him. When he woke, she was making a stand of bricks over the fire to support a kettle filled with snow.
It looks like late afternoon outside, she said, but it could be morning, or noon for that matter. The storm's as thick as ever. They can't track us, and if they did, still they couldn't get in this place. This kettle was in the cache with the blankets, and there's a bag of dried peas. We'll do well enough here.
The hard, delicate face turned to him with a faint smile.
It's dark, though. I don't like the thick walls and the dark.
It's better than bandaged eyes. Though you saved my life with that bandage. Blind Horescence was better off than dead Falk. He hesitated and then asked,
What moved you to save me?
She shrugged, still with a faint, reluctant smile.
Fellow prisoners. They always say wanderers are clever at ruses and disguises. Did you not hear them call me Fox Woman? Let me look at those hurts of yours. I brought my bag of tricks.
Are wanderers all good healers, too?
We have certain skills.
And you know the old tongue. You have not forgotten man's old way, like the Basnaska.
Yes, we all know Galactica. Look there, the rim of your ear was frostbitten yesterday, because you took the tie from your hood for me to hold.
I can't look at it, Falk said amiably, submitting to her doctoring. I don't need to, usually. As she dressed the still unhealed cut on his left temple, she glanced once or twice sidelong at his face, and at last she ventured,
There are many foresters with such eyes as yours, no doubt.
None. Evidently the code prevailed. She asked nothing, and he, having resolved to confide in no one, volunteered nothing. But his own curiosity got the better of him, and he said, They don't frighten you, then, these cat eyes?
No, she answered in her quiet way. You frightened me only once, when you shot so fast.
He would have raised the whole camp.
I know, but we carry no guns. You shot so quick, I was frightened. It was like a terrible thing I saw once when I was a child. A man who killed another with a gun, quicker than thought, like that. He was one of the raises.
Raises?
Oh, one meets with them in the mountains sometimes.
I know very little of the mountains. She explained, though as if unwillingly.
You know the law of the lords. They do not kill, you know. When there is a murderer in their city, they cannot kill him to stop him. So they make him into a raise. It is something they do to the mind. They can turn him loose, and he starts to live anew, innocent. This man I spoke of was older than you, but had a mind like a little child. But he got a gun in his hands, and his hands knew how to use it, and he shot a man very close up, like you did."
Falk was silent. He glanced across the fire at his handgun, lying atop his pack, the marvelous little tool that had started his fires, provided his meat, and lighted his darkness all his long way. There had been no knowledge in his hands of how to use the thing, had there? Metok had taught him how to shoot. He had learned from Metok, and grown skillful by hunting, he was sure of it. He could not be a mere freak and criminal given a second chance by the arrogant charity of the lords of Estach. Yet was that no more plausible than his own vague dreams and notions of his origin? How do they do this to a man's mind?
I do not know.
They might do it, he said harshly, not only to criminals, but to rebels.
What are rebels?
She spoke Galactica much more fluently than he, but she had never heard that word. She had finished dressing his hurt and was carefully tucking her few medicaments away in her pouch. He turned around to her so abruptly that she looked up startled, drawing back a little. "Have you ever seen eyes like mine, Estrell?"
"No."
"You know the city?"
"Estach? Yes, I have been there."
"Then you have seen the Shing?"
"You are no Shing."
"No. But I am going among them," he spoke fiercely. "But I dread..." He stopped. Estrell closed the medicine pouch and put it in her pack.
"Estach is strange to men from the lonely houses and the far lands," she said at last in her soft, careful voice. "But I have walked its streets with no harm. Many people live there, in no fear of the lords. You need not go in dread. The lords are very powerful, but much is told of Estach that is not true."
Her eyes met his. With sudden decision, summoning what paraverbal skill he had, he bespoke her for the first time. "Then tell me what is true of Estach." She shook her head, answering aloud,
"I have saved your life, and you mine, and we are companions and fellow wanderers perhaps for a while, but I will not bespeak you or any person met by chance, not now, nor ever."
"Do you think me a Shing after all?" he asked ironically, a little humiliated, knowing she was right.
"Who can be sure?" she said,
and then added with her faint smile,
"Though I would find it hard to believe of you." "There, the snow in the kettle has melted down. I'll go up and get more. It takes so much to make a little water, and we are both thirsty. You are called Falk?"
He nodded, watching her.
"Don't mistrust me, Falk," she said. "Let me prove myself to you. Mind speech proves nothing, and trust is a thing that must grow from actions across the days."
"Water it, then," said Falk, "and I hope it grows." Later, in the long night and silence of the cavern, he roused from sleep to see her sitting hunched by the embers, her tawny head bowed on her knees. He spoke her name.
"I'm cold," she said. "There's no warmth left."
"Come over to me," he spoke sleepily, smiling. She did not answer, but presently she came to him across the red-lit darkness, naked except for the pale jade stone between her breasts. She was slight and shaking with the cold. In his mind, which was in certain aspects that of a very young man, he had resolved not to touch her who had endured so much from the savages. But she murmured to him,
"Make me warm. Let me have solace."
And he blazed up like fire in the wind, all resolution swept away by her presence and her utter compliance. She lay all night in his arms, by the ashes of the fire. 3 more days and nights in the cavern, while the blizzard renewed and spent itself overhead, Falk and Estrelle passed in sleep and lovemaking. She was always the same, yielding, acquiescent. He, having only the memory of the pleasant and joyful love he had shared with Parth, was bewildered by the insatiability and violence of the desire Estrelle roused in him. Often the thought of Parth came to him accompanied by a vivid image, the memory of a spring of clear, quick water that rose among rocks in a shadowy place in the forest near the clearing. But no memory quenched his thirst, and again he would seek satisfaction in Estrelle's fathomless submissiveness and find, at least, exhaustion. Once it all turned to uncomprehended anger. He accused her. "You only take me because you think you have to, that I'd have raped you otherwise."
"And you would not?"
"No," he said, believing it. "I don't want you to serve me, to obey me. Isn't it warmth, human warmth, we both want?"
"Yes," she whispered.
He would not come near her for a while. He resolved he would not touch her again. He went off by himself with his light gun to explore the strange place they were in. After several hundred paces, the cavern narrowed, becoming a high, wide, level tunnel. Black and still, it led him on perfectly straight for a long time, then turned without narrowing or branching, and around the dark turning went on and on. His steps echoed dully. Nothing caught any brightness or cast any shadow from his light. He walked till he was weary and hungry, then turned. It was all the same, leading nowhere. He came back to Estrelle, to the endless promise and unfulfillment of her embrace. The storm was over. A night's rain had laid the black earth bare, and the last hollowed drifts of snow dripped and sparkled. Falk stood at the top of the stairway, sunlight on his hair, wind fresh on his face and in his lungs. He felt like a mole, done hibernating, like a rat come out of a hole. "Let's go," he called to Estrelle, and went back down to the cavern only to help her pack up quickly and clear out. He had asked her if she knew where her people were, and she had answered, "Probably far ahead in the west by now." "Did they know you were crossing Basnaska territory alone?"
"Alone? It's only in fairy tales from the time of the cities that women ever go anywhere alone. A man was with me. The Basnaska killed him."
Her delicate face was set, unexpressive. Falk began to explain to himself then her curious passivity, the want of response that had seemed almost a betrayal of his strong feeling. She had borne too much and could no longer respond. Who was the companion the Basnaska had killed? It was none of Falk's business to know until she wanted to tell him. But his anger was gone, and from that time on he treated Estrelle with confidence and with tenderness. "Can I help you look for your people?" she said softly.
"You are a kind man, Falk, but they will be far ahead, and I cannot comb all the western plains."
The lost, patient note in her voice moved him. "Come west with me, then, till you get news of them. You know what way I take." It was still hard for him to say the name Estach, which in the tongue of the forest was an obscenity, abominable. He was not yet used to the way Estrelle spoke of the Shing city as a mere place among other places. She hesitated, but when he pressed her, she agreed to come with him. That pleased him, because of his desire for her and his pity for her, because of the loneliness he had known and did not wish to know again. They set off together through the cold sunshine and the wind. Falk's heart was light at being outside, at being free, at going on. Today, the end of the journey did not matter. The day was bright, the broad, bright clouds sailed overhead, the way itself was its end. He went on, the gentle, docile, unwearying woman walking by his side.